Now, the next question is, what do you want me to talk about tonight?
Women.
About women. Is that a good idea?
Yeah.
Well, okay, here we go. So, women. I know all about women, having been a monk for 40 years. So, basically, one of the things I have noticed is when you see a child, we did a baby blessing this afternoon, and when you see a child, you have to ask these days, is it a boy or is it a girl? In the old days, boys would wear blue, girls would wear pink. It was really easy to find out, but these days you don't know. Even the way they dress, you don't know who's a boy and who's a girl. I have a lot of problem with that, you know, who's men and who's women, because I go overseas a lot, and when you go into foreign countries at the airport, you have to find the toilet, and sometimes they put the toilet signs up in a language I can't understand, so I have to look at the figures. And I look at the figures and I look at myself and I go in the wrong cubicle. So that doesn't really help understand who a man or a woman is. But usually it's only at a certain age. When you get to puberty, then men and women, they'll be divided. You know, men look like men, women look like women. And after we go through the procreation years and we get old, then men and women all come together again. It's true, you get your flat breasts, you know, we get sort of, you know, grey hair. We all look the same again. I quite like that idea. You know, we only separate from being male and female, you know, basically, the way we look, only at a certain time in our life. And once that's passed, you know, we start together looking pretty much the same, and we end up together pretty much the same. And I think that's really quite nice. The difference is only there for, you know, procreation, you know, getting some family. And apart from that, there's no real difference to males and women, men and women. So because of that, it makes life very easy, especially when you're a monk. Because when I was in Thailand, when I first became a monk, I was taught it's not just men and women, there are three genders. Men, women, and monks. And monks mean, no, monks and nuns. It's we're almost like a separate gender. And it's really wonderful being a monk and being outside of all the gender issues, in the sense that, you know, we're not out to get a girlfriend or boyfriend. We're outside of the gender issue, which means that we can get some really good understanding about relationships. Simply because, you know, we're not involved. We're standing back. And if you want to know what I mean, in life, to get perspective on things, you've got to get detached a little bit from things. I did give you an indication of that in the method of meditation which I taught, where when you have your thinking, if you really get sucked into the thinking, you know, you're lost, it's grabbed you. But if you can just detach yourself a little bit from the thinking, now even just imagining you're sitting here and the thinking is out there, it's very easy to let it go. Now, the simile I usually give about this, about a little bit of detachment, is when people watch the TV or watch movies. When I used to watch movies, I would notice that whenever it was like a frightening movie, then somebody in the audience, in the old cinemas, somebody would shout out, "Hey, look behind you!" And you know, no matter how hard you shouted, the monster could not hear you. That was a movie shot in Hollywood a long time ago, and the monster can't hear you. Or why it is that I used to remember before I became a monk, taking my girlfriend to the cinema, and whenever it was a very sad ending, she would start to cry, and I would start to laugh. I wasn't very sensitive when I was young. What are you crying for? It's only a movie, but he's dying. He's dead. I said, look, don't worry about him being dead. He'll get reincarnated in the next showing of the movie. It's only a movie. And then my girlfriend would say, well, look at you when you watch the football on the TV. You say, come on, pass the ball, pass the ball. They can't hear you. The game is on the other side of the US, and you're shouting at the TV screen here in Sacramento. Why do people do that? Why do they get emotionally entangled in the movie or in the ball game? Literally, you find you're getting sucked into the screen. It's like you're in there, in the movie set when someone is being shot. It's like you're in there in the stands, in the bleachers of the football game, so people can actually hear you. That is the delusion when it gets sucked into a movie or something on the TV. And that's exactly what happens when you get lost in the thought. You get sucked in to the thinking, into the future, into the past, into the fantasy, and it's no different than the things which you see on the TV or on the movies. Sometimes people wonder, and they're a bit scared about monks and nuns who are great meditators, because sometimes people are afraid that we can read your mind. Don't worry about that, because anyone who can read the mind, we only read about one or two minds, and that's it. We don't want to read that rubbish anymore. Honestly, who would want to read your mind? So you're perfectly safe, you don't do that. But when you really get into that mind, those thoughts, they really look really important. So when you get a separation, then you can get some perspective, and you find the problems get easily solved. You're not so entangled. And the same with the male-female business. When you can separate yourself, you're not so entangled with things. And you get perspective, and it's easy to understand what is going on. And it's the same that, you know, the last time I came through Sacramento was in 1969. It's changed a bit since then. Because I was just before going to university, had a nice few months, came over to the United States. I got very bored in the US in 69. It was just the same as Europe, you know, culturally pretty similar. So I decided to follow a dream and go to Central America, you know, to a totally different culture. And I always was fascinated by these great pyramids which they had built in the jungles of the Yucatan Peninsula. And so it took quite a few days to get down through Mexico and then through Guatemala and find my way on the fishing boats, old trucks, anything to go into the middle of the jungle in the Yucatan Peninsula of northeastern Guatemala. And it took me about 3 or 4 days to get there. But when I got to this old ancient site of pyramids in Tikal, there was no one there. I think I noticed one archaeologist and no one else. There was no place you'd get a cup of tea or coffee, no souvenir store, no fences. It was a free-for-all. Now, I was a boy. Only just turned 18. And what boys do if they see a pyramid is climbing. Oh. It's a boy thing, okay? So I don't know why we do that. Maybe it's in our genes. So I climbed the pyramid, not knowing at all what I would find on the top or why those pyramids were built there in the jungle at all. But you know that as soon as I got to the top of that pyramid, I could understand exactly why they were there. And the reason was this. For 3 or 4 days, I would be traveling through the jungle. There was real jungle, real rainforest. I don't know if it's still there. It's probably mostly been logged or cleared or big roads through it. But there was a single track road, you know, just big enough, only just for a car or a truck to go through. And it was winding through the jungle. As soon as the path was cleared, the jungle was just so alive. The trees, the vines would grow over the top of the road. So you are always traveling through tunnels. Even on the river boats, everything was going right over the river. So again, it was another little tunnel you were going through. And I never realized what happens when 3 or 4 days of traveling through tunnels, I had never seen the sky, nor the horizon. But when I got to the top of the first pyramid, what I noticed was at the very top there was a little room, and that room was just above the tree line of the jungle. And for the first time in days, I could see infinity in all directions, with nothing between me and as far as you want to see. And I could look down on the jungle from above, and I could see the path which I'd come that day. It didn't look that far, but it had taken me all day to come, because the jungle paths were very slow and torturous to come across. And I realized that this was a great symbol of what a spiritual practice is, to somehow leave the jungle of our lives, find a pyramid, find some way of separating from the thoughts, the emotions, from the man-woman thing, whatever it is you are caught up in, to get above and beyond, to have what we call the Google Map view. So you can see where you are, and you can see how everything comes together. And when we have that degree of detachment, finding the pyramids in our life, to take time out and get the big view, detach a little bit from the jungle, then we can understand what this world is all about, and what this man-women thing is all about, and what meditation is all about, and what life is all about. We have to somehow find a way of separating. And once we have separated, we understand where we are, what we're doing. And I really started to imagine what it would have been like for someone who'd been born in that jungle, lived all their life in that jungle, some young Indian boy or girl who through some act of initiation was taken by a priest up that pyramid, and for the first time in their life, seeing where they lived. They would literally have blown their minds. They'd have understood where all the villages and all the roads and the rivers, you know, lay, and how they all connected together. But more importantly, just to see this great emptiness which surrounded everything in all directions, and which embraced everything and connected it all together, with nothing between that young Indian boy or girl and infinity. The metaphor was so strong, you can understand how that would nearly in all occasions give a spiritual awakening, an understanding of what we're doing here, because this is what life is like sometimes. It's just this really, really, really big, confusing jungle of thoughts and emotions and activities and events, and trying to make some sense out of it when you're right in the middle of the jungle is really, really difficult. Just like the women and the men thing. So please, don't get too hard on the men. Please, don't get too hard on the women. It's just because we've been stuck in this jungle. We've been taught what a man is supposed to do and what a woman is supposed to do. And sometimes we need to take a bit of time out, emotional time out, to leave this jungle to see what it really is all about. There's no difference, basically. Now, for those of you who do want good relationships, because these days in the United States, like anywhere else in the world, it's so hard for men and women to get along. And so I've been telling all my young disciples, if you are looking for a partner in this world, follow this, quite a few bits of advice. First of all, I tell young men, never ever marry a beautiful woman. If she's hot, leave her alone. Because the reason is this, it's obvious to me as a monk, because I'm out of all of this. If you marry a beautiful girl, then when you go off on business somewhere, or you go on some retreat, you don't know what she's up to. Because she's attractive, other guys will want her. So you'll be jealous, you'll be worried all your married life. But look, if you marry an ugly girl, you've got nothing to worry about. You go on a retreat for 9 or 10 days, no one wants to, so you're safe. No worries at all. Girls, never marry a rich guy. If you marry a wealthy guy, he can have mistress. But if he's poor, can't afford a mistress, no girl wants him. So girls, marry poor boys. Boys, marry ugly girls. That's my recipe, my monk's wisdom for everybody. Okay, that's as much as I know about these things, which is not that much. But, really importantly, with men and women, please lower your expectations of your partner. That's what really wrecks relationships. We have far too high expectations. That's our problem. So lower your expectations. Like this friend over in Singapore told me many years ago, this was in the Dung Book, that's what they call, you know, who ordered this truckload of dung, that's called the Dung Book. But anyway, that's my first book. When she got married, her new father-in-law took his new son-in-law aside to give him some advice. He told his new son-in-law, he said, "You probably love my daughter really, really much." He said, "Oh yeah, she's so wonderful. She's so beautiful. I'm so lucky to marry someone like that. Everything about her is so charming. Even the way she picks her nose is so wonderful." And she didn't actually say that, I added that, but you know what I mean. That when you're in love, everything about her is just so wonderful and beautiful. That's what the father-in-law said to the son-in-law. Said, "Look, that's what it's like when you first fall in love. Everything about her is just wonderful. But please remember this, son-in-law. In about 1 or 2 years, maybe 3 years, you will start to see the faults and the defects in my daughter. But I want you to remember, when you start to see her faults, please remember, if she never had those defects to begin with, she would have married someone much better than you." And there's a lot of wisdom in that. So, no one is absolutely perfect. And that is one of the reasons why we have love. We can't love a perfect person. What's the point? And that's too easy. When we lower our expectations, we have a different understanding of women and men as human beings with defects who are growing, who are learning. I told this little story the first talk I gave, but that was over in San Francisco, so I hope you weren't there. And that was a story of many people these days. They get lack of self-esteem, they feel they're really awful, and some people even come up to me and say they can't find a partner because they are damaged goods. Something has happened to them early in their life, and that's how they look at themselves. And I tell them this story, because where I live and where these nuns live, or some of the nuns live, is over in forests, with forest monks, forest nuns. So when people come and tell me that they can't find a partner in life, I tell them, "Look, go into the forest and please find me a perfect tree. A tree which is dead straight, which is not leaning to the left or the right, which is not crooked. A tree with all the branches equally spaced. And leaves which aren't brown or yellow, and the green leaves not being eaten by insects, but perfect green leaves. And bark which is perfectly smooth, with no cankers, with no damage on the bark. If you can find a tree like that, it must be some government plantation, botanical garden, some place which ain't natural. Because real trees in real natural forests are crooked and bent, with branches hanging off, with leaves yellow and brown and eaten by insects, with damage on the bark. And in fact, when I see trees like that, the crooked bent ones, with all sort of gnarled things on their bark, on their trunk, those are the trees which I like the best. The crooked ones, the damaged ones, they are the beautiful trees in the forest. So if you ever think that you are damaged goods, welcome. You belong as one of the beautiful trees in the forest. If you've got a husband who's crooked and bent, he's gorgeous. If you've got a wife with things broken off, then she is gorgeous. Why? Because she is real, just like the beautiful trees in the forest. So, with the men and women thing, we actually change our perception of beautiful to something which is real and natural. Now that is wisdom. And that means when you change your perception of what is beautiful, what is real, what is natural, what is attractive, it's amazing that we can stop all this ridiculous thing, you know, which we do, of going to beauty parlors, when you have boob jobs, when we have hair jobs, nose jobs, or I don't know, whatever jobs you have. I had no jobs. And you can be yourself and be loved for who you are and love others for who they are, rather than having some artificial conditioned idea of what beauty really is. As a monk, we see beauty in other ways. As a nun, we've been learned not to actually to look at these glossy magazines or these TV ads of what beauty is. For me, a beautiful person is one who has this wonderful smile. That's what always attracts me, this beautiful, gorgeous smile coming from a happy heart within. And because that is so attractive to people, I tell them, look, if you want to go to a beauty parlor or some salon, it costs you a lot of money. Instead, come to the temple. I will teach you how to smile and be happy, and thereby be really attractive. And this is what I teach people. I teach people, for health reasons, always when you first get up in the morning, do 10 push-ups. Do you do 10 push-ups in the morning? I do 10 push-ups in the morning, and it doesn't take that much time or energy. Even if you're sick, you can do these 10 push-ups. All you need to do is stand in front of the mirror. Your feet about, you know, 2 or 3 feet apart. Look in the mirror and get your 2 fingers, side of the mouth, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Do some smiling exercises. Because some of you look so miserable sometimes because you haven't had exercise. Now you may think that's a bit silly or a joke, but I teach that to so many people and it really helps. Number one, they start the day laughing at themselves. And they exercise these muscles, which means it's much easier for them to smile. Which means they do become more attractive. Which means they have a much better social life. People like them at work because you smile at people. That smile is really, really important. And don't think it comes naturally, like anything else in life. You train. So you can try things like that. And of course, as soon as you smile and get happy, it increases your health, increases the secretion of endorphins into the bloodstream, nature's immune system encourager or enforcer, or whatever it's called. Enhances your immune system. It makes you more attractive, and that's where I get all my donations from, by smiling a lot. Yes.
I was hoping you might talk about the category of monastic women.
Kind of monastics, okay. Monastics. There is no monastic women or monastic men. Look, we all look the same. If I didn't speak, can you tell the difference between me and these people over there? Which one is a man? Sometimes we should mix ourselves all up and you have a competition. Who's a male, who's a female? Because these robes make us all look androgynous. But I think what you really want to say is all this legal system, political system about women monks and male monks or nuns or whatever they're called. Now, all of that sort of stuff is okay, let's say it. It's a lot of bullshit. basically, male, female. The Buddha allowed both genders to become monks, to become monastics. And it was right there, right from the very beginning. For those of you who don't know the story, no, this is Buddhist story from the sutras. After the Buddha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, this guy, Mara, he was called, this is a guy who was trying to stop people getting enlightened, trying to stop good things happening. And it's interesting, just for a little bit of interest, this fellow Mara is supposed to be like a heavenly being who is the head of the Parinimitta Wasawati realm, which means the realm of those who control others. He is the head control freak in chief of the universe. Now that is the problem, control. Any controlling, now that causes a lot of suffering in life. And this particular guy wants to control everybody, and when someone like a Buddha comes along and escapes from control by letting go of control, being free, that really pisses off Mara. He really gets upset. Please excuse me for using American language. I always have to say the Buddha said, Aranavibhanga Sutra and also in the Vinaya, monks and nuns, you should always teach in the local language. This is the US. You use the word piss off, I use the word piss off. Really pissed off Mara. And what Mara did, he really tried everything to stop the Buddha becoming enlightened. Failed miserably. So then went to plan B. He went up to the newly enlightened Buddha and said, well done, you're enlightened, congratulations. Now, don't teach anybody. Go around teaching people, it's a really pain in the butt. They won't listen to you, they'll ask silly questions, and it can cause you all sorts of problems. Just, well done, you're enlightened, now just go and disappear from the universe. And the Buddha said, no, I will not disappear from the universe until I have established the monastic sangha of monks, the monastic sangha of women, the lay men, the lay women, those four parisars, the four groups. Once they are well established, strong, and lots of enlightened beings in all of those four groups, then I will leave. Now that's such an important thing to quote. This was the Buddha's intention from the very beginning. After becoming enlightened, nothing else to do except to teach and to establish these four groups so the Dharma could continue with these four groups forever. Or at least for a really, really long time. But then, what was it, 45 years later at the Japala shrine, the Mara came again and said, look, you're finished, you've done it. Lots of enlightened monks, lots of enlightened nuns, lots of great laymen, laywomen, meditators. You're done. And we say, yeah, fair enough. And so 3 months later he passed away. Now this was the goal from the very beginning. And so, now when sort of the Bhikkhuni Sangha disappeared in some traditions, not all traditions, it was just fulfilling the Buddha's original intentions. Actually to get them going again, to re-establish them. So we've done that. Woohoo! So what's the problem? I don't know what the problem is. Except one thing which I have been doing. Now many of you know that I was instrumental in just starting off the Bhikkhuni Sangha in the West, the first Western ordination done in the West over in Australia. But that's not enough. Because as soon as you ordain somebody, it's like giving birth to somebody. You don't just give birth and leave the baby in hospital. You've got to nurture them and teach them and make sure they're well supported. So I realise that's part of my job, to make sure that the new bhikkhunis are well trained and well taught. They have plenty of opportunity, you know, to have teachings in meditation and also the rules. And number two, to make sure they're well supported. Got decent places to stay. So that's actually what I'm here for, you know, to actually not just to give a little bit of teaching, because those teachings you can do from a distance on YouTube and stuff. But what is really important is they've got a decent place to stay. And quite frankly, I'm a monk, especially Asian people, you give too much money to fat monks like me. And these poor nuns, look at them. Thin and scrawny. They make me feel embarrassed. But actually, I've got to explain things to you. This is not fat. I have now completed my 40th year as a bhikkhu, and it's something to know every year that you are a fully ordained monastic, you're increasing compassion every year. Your heart gets bigger every year. Now, after 40 years of compassionate practice, my heart is so big, it's pushing out my tummy. It's got to go somewhere. It can't push out the ribs. They're already too tight. So it pushes out my tummy. This is not fat. This is a sign of a very, very big heart. That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. But anyway, that's actually what is happening. So once you know you have enough, you've got women in Buddhism. And the other thing which I like to say is that for many men who are Buddhists, you feel embarrassed sometimes. So much about Buddhism is so beautiful. You know, we're supposed to be talking about gender equality. Gays, lesbians, transgenders are welcomed. No, there's nothing in Buddhism which discriminates against anybody. Any race, any age is welcome. And no one is demeaned. And there's such beautiful teachings, wise teachings, psychology teachings. But the one thing which people for years, when I was young, felt uncomfortable with, where are the nuns? You go to Thailand, you go to Burma, great teachings, inspiring teachers, great meditation, but where are the nuns? So something is wrong or missing there. And it's one of my favourite sayings, which I share with you, it's an old Chinese saying, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. Too many people complain, yeah, we should have this, we should have that. Do something about it. So after that conference in Hamburg, which made it very clear, it was a big bhikkhuni conference in Hamburg, which was obvious that there was no legal impediment to the ordination of bhikkhunis. But then people were complaining that, look, we're all talking about it, no one's doing anything. So I did something about it. And other people do something about it. Okay, I was the first in the line. And I always say, the front truck in the convoy gets all the bugs on the windscreen. But I've got the bugs on the windscreen, who cares? So the other trucks coming behind don't get so many bugs. It's a wonderful thing to do. And it makes me proud to be a Buddhist. This religion, this path which I love and care for and really inspires me, you can make it better, make it more acceptable. Because some of the teachings which I have, just like that simile of getting on top of the pyramid and seeing at a great distance and seeing how everything works, just the great psychologies of Buddhism which is taking over, you know, the Western world, Buddhist psychology really rocks, and we're taking it further. Now that little book which was presented, it takes mindfulness to the next level. Mindfulness is not enough. Add kindness. When mindfulness and kindness come together, they become kindfulness, which is the title of that book. Kindfulness. You find out that really has power. If you want to know a nice funny story, why kindfulness rocks and mindfulness is not enough. Once, there was a very wealthy lady came to the temple or to this place to do some meditation and for a talk. And when she came to the temple, because she was a very wealthy woman in a big mansion, she had a guard on the gate of her house. And she told the guard, "Guard, there are many burglars in Sacramento. And my house is very wealthy, so I want you to be very mindful tonight, so you can guard my house." And then she went to this place to do some meditation and listen to a talk. And after the talk, she was really inspired and happy, but as soon as she got back home, she found the burglars had been in her house And she was very upset at her guard. She went straight to the guardhouse and scolded that man. I told you to be mindful, and I've been burgled. And he said, but madam, I was mindful. What do you mean you were mindful? Well, I saw the burglars going into your house, and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in. I noticed them taking your jewelry out, and I was mindful, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw them going in with their truck again, the truck going in. I was mindful all the time, madam. Is mindfulness enough? When your happiness and peace and health is being stolen, mindfulness is not enough. But you add kindness there. It's kind to your employee that you actually call the police. Or you try and lock the doors or stop the burglars going in so they don't steal things. So mindfulness must always be with kindness as well. When you have kindness, you have a very powerful combination. And I was teaching a little bit like that when we started the meditation. How do you relax your body? You're not just being aware of it, but being kind to it as well. And I'll tell you one powerful story, which you may have heard on the YouTube talks, of how mindfulness and kindness can heal real big physical problems. Because 2 or 3 years ago, I had food poisoning. Now, food poisoning is when your stomach cramps up, your intestines, you know, it's like they're being tortured. And you know, you almost scream out in pain. It hurts that much. Now the reason I got food poisoning is because, you know, we have what's called dana. Now you bring the food to us. We don't really know what we're eating. So indigestion and food poisoning is what I call an occupational hazard from our colonel. We got hardly much control. So, I had this food poisoning, I was in the forest, you know, it's a bit too far, you know, to get to a doctor. So instead of going to a doctor, you have your own little methods of dealing with food poisoning. You go, oh, the stomach is really painful. So what do? Mindful. Awareness means not judging, not trying to run away from these things, not trying to control them, just being with them. Being with the feelings. So, first of all, be with the feelings of pain in the body. As I said, that gives you feedback. You can actually feel whether those sensations are getting worse or getting better. And I know from practice what makes them better is kindness, compassion. Letting them be. Not putting fear, control, or any other pressure on them. Just letting them be. Being kind to them. In the same way that maybe when you were a child and you were very, very sick, and your mom came to your bedside and just was really kind to you, just stroked your head, said, darling, it'll be okay, mom's here. And just being with your mom and feeling her kindness just relaxed you and probably alleviated your sickness, if not even healed it. The kindness is such a wonderful therapeutic power. So I know that. I gave kindness to my food poisoning. And I noticed my awareness showed me that the pain was getting less. And less, and less, and less. All it took me, this is absolute truth, 20 minutes, and there was no pain left in my intestines. Food poisoning gone. How that can happen without any medication, you know, to this day I don't really know, but I imagined what had happened. I imagined that because I don't know too much about biology, it's a long time since I was at school, but I do remember some of these bacteria, seeing pictures of them, little blobs with all these like tentacles coming out, and I sort of imagined that these little blobs, all their tentacles were really cross-legged, one tentacle over the other, and all the bacteria sitting quietly in meditation in my tummy, which is why they weren't causing me any trouble. That's how I imagined it. It's probably totally wrong, but anyway, they did cause me any problem, and that was it in the end. It was just that mindfulness and kindness solved the problem. And there's so many beautiful things like that you can do. Anxiety. And there's so many people have anxiety and panic disorders these days. It's so easy to fix without taking all this medication. There was one of my disciples, or she wasn't at the time, but she certainly is now, over in Adelaide, a young student, she was doing dentistry, and she had this very severe anxiety disorder. It was so bad that she was bedridden. And her doctor, her GP, psychologist, psychiatrist, no one could fix her. And so she was there in bed, she couldn't even get out of bed. She was very fortunate to have a very special boyfriend who would cook and clean and look after her. Boyfriends like that don't come very easily, anyway. And so, the second good bit of fortune she had, her uncle in Perth was a close disciple of mine. So uncle said, go and call Ajahn Brahm. She called me, and she told me the problem, and I asked her, when you have a panic attack, where do you feel it in your body? And she said, in my chest. I said, where in your chest? Well, I don't know, somewhere in my chest, she said. But that's not good enough. I want coordinates, exact positions, where your panic attacks appears in your body. Give me a call in 2 or 3 days when you can answer me. Now, there was 2 things which I was making her do here. Number one, for her to take some control over her therapy, which is really important, because when you trust your doctor or you trust your therapist or even your teacher too much, it means you're not taking responsibility for your practice and for your health. And it's important that you take ownership of this. And number two, I was asking her to be much more aware of the panic attacks and how it manifests on her body. After 2 days, she was a very smart girl. She said exactly where it was in her body. I said, well done. Now, what does it feel like when you have a panic attack? Well, it was just tense. Not good enough. I want a big description. Again, I was asking her to be, again, more aware of these feelings when she has a panic attack, so she could describe them in detail to a stranger. 2 or 3 days later, she gave this very long description of the feelings, the type of feelings, how they change, where they manifest. I thought, great, she's actually ticked the mindfulness box. She's been aware enough to actually to do the next stage of the therapy. I said, now, you're aware of those feelings. Next time you have a panic attack, get your hand and massage that area with as much kindness as you possibly can. And if you can't do that, ask your boyfriend to do that. That's what boyfriends are there for. And she said, okay. And 2 days later, she called me back again, or 3 days later, and said, did you follow my instructions? I said, yes. When I had a panic attack, I massaged, or if I felt really too weak, I got my boyfriend to massage that area. I said, what happened to the feeling in your chest? She said, well, it went away. Then I said, what happened to the panic attack, the anxiety? And I will always remember the pause when I asked that question. It's what we call the light bulb moment. After a second or two, she said, the anxiety went too. Exactly, I said. Every emotion has a corresponding physical feeling in your body. Sometimes we find it so difficult to control or work with our emotions. We're not skillful enough. But if we can find out where in the body they are located, and work with the physical feelings, and give it awareness first of all, and then kindness, you will find the physical feeling will relax and disappear, and with it, the emotion which caused that physical feeling. In this case, the anxiety. It worked. Within a week, she was out of bed, went back to university, she got first class honours in dentistry, and about 6 months after finishing her university, she married her boyfriend, and I did the ceremony for them. That was so sweet, Lloyd and Jippy. And they're still together, always come and see me, because I saved her life. Now, I've been teaching that for a long time. One other disciple recently, she's a doctor. Actually, her relations, her Bangladeshi relations, they came to the talk which I gave in San Fran. And she was a doctor. She was treating a patient with anxiety, panic disorder. She was so bad, she was hospitalized for weeks, you know, with an oxygen mask on because she couldn't breathe. Her anxiety was so severe. And so what the doctors do in Australia, US, is the same. They go through all the medications. The first one, the second one, the third one, the fourth one. If this doesn't work, try this one. That's how doctors are trained. So she got to the last medication and nothing was working. So she told me Thursday afternoon, she's about to finish work, no medication was working, so she thought, no one around. Adjunct Barnes method. Told her, be aware of the physical feeling whenever she has a panic attack. Take her hand, massage it. See what happens. And she told me with great glee on Friday evening that when she went to work the following morning, Friday morning, the oxygen mask was off the lady. The lady said, I did that, it worked, I feel great, I'm going home. Another success. Because this is something which, as a meditator, you understand. Every emotion, whether it's anger, especially fear, which sometimes can cripple people, all has a physical manifestation somewhere in your body. Be aware of that, be really mindful of it, fully mindful of it, and find some kindness, compassion to relax it. The physical feeling goes, and the emotional counterpart goes as well. Problem solved. Very easy, with kindfulness, mindfulness together with kindness. So I have all these incredibly powerful teachings, you know, which we can help people enormously in this world. But sometimes people say, oh, Buddhism, there's no, it's just sexist like everything else. And when I see any thought like that, I thought, okay, no, we can't allow that. We've got to do something about it. And all this other, you know, all the different, not just men and women sex, all the other sects in Buddhism. Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, Zen. Oh, come on. How many Buddhas were there? There's only one Buddha, there's only a Dhamma. And so why do we have all these different types of Buddhism, you know, competing with each other? I'm very proud here that apparently in this group over here you get people from any type of Buddhism, and even people who aren't Buddhists to come and teach. Why not? So I was telling somebody earlier that, you know, I have tried really hard to try and combine the different types of Buddhism. So in order to do this, you know, three main types of Buddhism, and this is just historical, the Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. And so to get it all together, I've taken the H in Hinayana. And the aha from Mahayana. And the yana from Vajrayana. And that is, becomes my tradition, it's my vehicle. And it is the Hahayana. I'm a follower of the Hahayana. Yeah, you are as well, you're laughing. So you're Hahayanist as well. Because why not put a little bit of fun, you know, into Buddhism? Into religion. I don't know about you, this is my 64th year now. I did go to church when I was young. This was in London, and all the seats are called pews, hardwood, not one cushion there. And the study was really cold. And then the preacher, did he ever tell a joke? No way. Because all the sins you have done, all the times you're going to go to hell, wow, that was just a real turn-off. So we don't do that anymore. Tell a few jokes and actually people come here. This is true. I told this afternoon. I got an email from somebody. You know, some of the talks on YouTube saved her life, but she told me where she got those talks from. She was listening to some radio show on National Public Radio here in the US, and they were interviewing one of the writers of Saturday Night Live. And this writer from Saturday Night Live, which is the comedy show in the US, the most famous comedy show, Saturday Night Live, one of the writers was feeling a bit depressed and was listening to one of Ajahn Brahm's talks on YouTube and solved his problem, and that's where she learned it. So she looked at these stuff on YouTube for me, and she solved her problem as well. And that's what I found out. The writers of Saturday Night Live, they listen to my talks, that's where they get all of their jokes. Maybe not. You never know. So, this is actually how you can put a bit more fun into the Dhamma. Because look, if it's not fun, is it really worth doing? If it's not letting go, what is Buddhism anyway? Letting go of suffering, finding solutions to problems in life. And sometimes when we see things in a funny way, we actually see things in a true way. All humour is laughing at the human condition and just the sort of silly, funny things which we do in life. You know, just like, you know, the old three rings of marriage joke. You know the three rings of marriage? The first ring is the engagement ring. The second ring is the wedding ring. And the third ring is the suffer ring. Why are you laughing? Because it describes the truth. But you know, there was this couple once came to see me. They happened to be Thai Buddhists. They were sisters. And they came for some free counselling. You know, one of the reasons they come to monks and nuns for counselling is because we're cheap, we don't charge. We also give very good counselling too. So they came to the monk for free counselling. And the elder sister, her problem was her husband. You know, having a very difficult relationship, and she was at the point where she'd had enough. And she wanted some advice, you know, what to do, whether she could keep the marriage together or just divorce separately. So I gave her some advice, and then I asked her younger sister, what's your problem? And her problem was she could never get a stable relationship. She'd find a boy, go out with him for a month or 2 months, and then it'd all break up. She wanted a husband, but she couldn't find one. And hearing what she was saying, a solution came to my mind. So look, your elder sister, she's got a husband she doesn't want. You've got one. What's the problem? That's a mark. I didn't say any problem. Come on, share. Your sisters. But I wouldn't have any of that. So then I told, you know, the deeper teaching, which is really important for each one of you, is that the first sister had a husband. And she was experiencing what all women have with husbands, to a greater or lesser extent. It's called in Buddhism husband suffering. Husband dukkha. And I said to her, look, if you get rid of your husband, you won't have that suffering anymore. That will be the end of it. What you have is what your sister has, single woman suffering. Because that's most of our life. We think, once I get rid of this problem, then I'll be happy. All you're really doing is changing one form of suffering for another form of suffering. So sometimes you think, okay, forget about marriage. I'm going to ordain as a monk or as a nun. But I tell you, if you get ordained as a nun, you won't have husband suffering. You won't have single woman suffering. What will you have? Nun suffering. And ask them about it. So this change in situation doesn't change the fact that, you know, there's always some disappointment, there's some stress, if we don't know how to be content with what we have. A very simple teaching. And to understand it, again, I told this story a few days ago, but it's fresh in my mind. The last story, because it's getting a bit late, and we can actually ask some questions and answers, is that one of our monks went to teach in prison. And while he was in prison teaching, they got to like this monk, and after a while, you know, they invited him to stay behind a little bit longer for a cup of tea. He had a cup of tea, and they asked him, what's it like being a monk in the West? And he said all the things which a monk does, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And the prisoner said, even murderers don't have to get up that time. Just, you know, eating just a tiny breakfast, one main meal a day, all in the bowl. So even in solitary confinement, they give you a tray where things are separated. And all the other tough things we do, no TV, no sex, no sport, no movies, and sleeping on the floor. So, we all get beds with nice mattresses. If you go to my monastery, I live in a cave, I sleep on the floor. And when they heard how ascetic life is for monks or nuns, the prisoners said, that's terrible where you live. Why don't you come in here and stay? And they had a coins. That's why I'm never afraid. If I get caught and sent to jail, it's really comfortable in there. You don't have to go out giving any talks anywhere. You get 3 meals a day. You can watch the TV if you want to. If you want to go on a retreat, just punch a prison officer. You get 3 months solitary. Marvelous. But then I thought, why is it that actually many people like being nuns? They want to join monasteries. My monastery, and the nuns' monastery too, we all have long waiting lists of people wanting to ordain as soon as there's a place to ordain. Why is that? The only difference between prison and a monastery is in a monastery, people want to be there. In a prison, they don't want to be there. That's the only difference. It's not the austerity. It's whether you want to be there or whether you don't. And I realise that that is one of the secrets of happiness and suffering. Any place you do not want to be is a prison for you. It could be a relationship you hate, a job which you don't want to be in. It can be a body which you're not comfortable with. If you don't want to be here, you are in prison. How do you escape from the prisons of life? You don't need to change your partner, change your job, or change your body. Change your attitude. When you want to be here, then you are free. How many people understand the difference between prison and freedom? Anytime you don't want to be here, you're in prison. Anytime you're content to be here, with this old body, you know, your old wife, your old husband, your silly kids, you know, the stupid life. As long as you're happy to be here, then you are free. Okay, have we got time for any questions? I've always gone over the time. Any questions? Yes.
Yes, Bob, I have two questions.
Oh boy.
First question, I heard a story during the Buddha's time.
Yep.
The Buddha's stepmother had to fight really hard to become a nun.
Yep.
Because the Buddha was against it at first. I wonder what happened there.
Okay, I'll answer that question first of all. Why was the Buddha's stepmother, Mahapajapati, given such a hard time by the Buddha? And sometimes some of the sayings in the sutras don't make sense. At the same time, the Buddha made a prediction, if we ordain bhikkhunis, the Buddhism would only last for 500 years. It's 500, not 5,000, it's Panchasutta, it's the Pali. 500 years. Now that causes a lot of problems, because number one, the Buddha never made predictions anywhere else, so it's totally out of character. And if that he did actually say that, he was wrong. 2,500 years and Buddhism is still alive and kicking and strong and spreading all over the world. So most scholars, and I'm included here, said that could not have been said by the Buddha. The evidence is too strong that that could not be the Buddha's words. There's a lot of that sometimes in the sutras. We've got to find out, what did the Buddha say, what did he not say? Some of it was added in there, and that's almost certainly added in.
Yeah? Second question. How long would it take for someone to practice meditation to experience their first jhana?
First jhana, it only takes a moment, and that moment is called now. Forget about this how long business. Somebody's asked me twice already, before they ask me again, I'm going to say this question and answer again. They ask me, when is the best time to meditate? The best time to meditate is now. The worst time to meditate is later. If you understand that, you can answer your question. How long does it take? Forget about time. Next question, anyone somewhere? Okay, here, go, very good.
So I started meditating 5 years ago and studying the Eightfold Path. And, 5 years ago I thought I felt confident and I felt witty and sharp and I had a sense of how I fit, and 5 years later, I feel pretty dull and pretty.
So you're saying that you've been meditating for 5 years, first it worked, now it sucks.
Oh, not quite. Before I started meditating, I had a sense of, before I started studying, I had a sense of where I fit in the scheme of life. And
So well, sometimes, depends what type of meditation you do, but going back to that simile I said earlier about the getting up the pyramid, up the mountain, getting away from the thoughts, away from the life, the time out, so you can actually see things from a distance, instead of being so caught up in things. And that's what meditation does. Sometimes the thoughts stop and vanish, and you're really, really peaceful, and that's where insights come from. The old simile of your mind is like a lake in the mountains. All the thoughts, they're like waves on the surface of that lake. And even if some small thoughts on the surface of the lake, you can't see a perfect reflection of the moon and the stars above. The image is distorted, you don't know how you fit in. But when the lake is perfectly still, then you have an accurate reflection of the moon and the stars. So the whole point of meditation, and this I'm just going to add this here, this is a big thing for me, is learning how to be still. Please, please, please never think meditation is about concentration. That is a bad word, a very bad translation. If you think it's about concentration, you go on a meditation retreat and it becomes a concentration camp. This is about stillness. And to understand how to become still, I've said this many times, but it's important I say this here. To get your mind to be still. Now, this water stands for your mind. I'll ask Ayati to please help me here. She's a very honest nun. Are you very truthful? Very good. Yes, she is. I don't need to hold this water. I want you to tell me what's going on here, because I'm now going to hold this water perfectly still by trying to get my mind to be still. Has it become still yet, Ayati? Or is it moving? It's moving. And the reason is because I'm not paying any attention, so I'm now going to concentrate. I'll put it down here, sir. Concentrate. Concentrate. I really am trying to concentrate. What's happening to the water, IOT? Still moving? Still moving. This is how many people try to meditate, trying to hold their mind still. You can meditate for 5 years or 50 years, and you'll never become still. So there's a very easy way to meditate, and it is to put the damn thing down. Let it go. Now when I let it go, put it down, so easy to do, no effort, just the effort to stop and not interfere with things. Now, IT, how's the water going?
Don't worry.
Very good. Now, keep looking, because it does take a time. How's that? I have glasses on.
She's got really tight.
It looks pretty still to me. There's no way I can ever hold it that still. Do you agree? Come on, you're my friend. I'm not going to support this man. That's it. I'm not going to. No, actually, honestly, that is almost perfectly still now. Not moving at all. This is an earthquake in Sacramento. That is still. The reason is, if you don't believe, you try to hope. When you let things go, then it becomes still. This is the trick of meditation. Learning how to leave things alone. To be aware, to be kind. And then everything becomes perfectly still. And then you can actually see the reflection of things. And you realize you do belong. You may not be the straightest tree in the forest. You may be bent and crooked all over. And you realize, yes, I belong. Does that make any sense? Okay. Okay, another comment or question from anybody? Yeah.
How would you weigh playfulness as part of the practice?
Now, before I became a monk, I was a theoretical physicist at Cambridge University. And we were taught that playfulness is where you make all the great discoveries. Playfulness is where you take off the constraints and you just explore. Playfully explore with your mind as well. Right, I'll give you an example of this. That once when I was meditating, getting very still, in my mind I saw this image of this demon. Tongue hanging out, huge eyes, no pointed teeth, skull bones, skulls, and a garland of skulls around his neck, going right in front of me. Did I get scared? No way. Because I knew how to deal with these things playfully. Just like when I was at school, we called it doodling. I put Ray-Ban sunglasses over his big bulging eyes. I blacked out a couple of his teeth. I put a straw hat on his head with a flower coming out of it. And after just 1 or 2 minutes of playfulness, I totally humiliated that monster and it never came back again. That is what I mean. Playfulness means to explore. Try different things. For example, how many of you do Anapanasati meditation, breath meditation? Many of you do? How many of you ever tried backwards breath meditation? Because sometimes you do breath meditation, it gets really boring after a while. Breathing in, breathing out, gee. To do backwards breath meditation, very simple thing to do. When you watch your breath, watch the out breath first, and then the in breath. Instead of in, out, which is what most people do, breathing out first. You know, just try it. Breathing out first and then in. Out, in. It's totally different. So next time you do Anapanasati, do backwards breath meditation. Breathe out first and then in. So I invented that and it works. It makes things a bit fun. That is what playfulness does. It actually gives you greater insight and understanding when you play around with things. And that's actually how I was taught at Cambridge. Play around with all the apparatus. Mess around with it. Yeah, you know, you blow up things many times, but you get the Nobel Prize as well. So playfulness, the Nobel Prize in Buddhism is streaming enlightenment. So explore, play around. And for goodness sake, don't follow your teachers. Because when you follow your teachers, you just become clones of your teacher. And you know, all the teachers, Ajahn Chah, my teacher, he always would say, don't follow me. You know, this is one of the last things he said before he passed away. I was with him just until he had his stroke. He would actually get his hand out and he would try and imitate a crab with a broken leg. He said, once there was a mother crab with a broken leg, so she walked with a limp. And she told all her children, don't walk like a limp. I'm walking with a limp because I've got a broken leg. But all the little children also walk with a limp as well. And that was Ajahn Chah's last teaching, but just about. He said, look, now I've got my own idiosyncrasies, you know, the broken leg. Don't you disciples walk like me? And of course, what did they do? They all walk like me. Don't do that. Be yourself. Find out your Dhamma. Instead of just imitating other people. Yeah, okay. Another question? Yeah.
How do you keep someone's spirits up that is terminally ill in an excruciating pain?
Terminally ill, excruciating pain. First of all, the excruciating pain business. Sometimes when people are in chronic pain, excruciating pain, sometimes we actually add to it by saying, I don't want to be here. That simply of being in a prison is when you don't want to be here. But when you allow things to be, you are free. The time when I was in excruciating pain once, okay, it was only a toothache, but people afterwards have told me that toothaches can actually drive you crazy. And my toothache was so bad in the jungle, there was no doctor, medicine, or not even any any painkiller anywhere, because it was a very simple forest monastery. And I had a lot of willpower, but I couldn't beat down that pain. It was just driving me crazy. No way you'd go to sleep. Every time I tried to watch my breath, the pain just came straight in. And I tried doing some chanting, thinking that Buddhist chanting could somehow magically get rid of your pain. And I had to stop that because I was actually shouting at the top of my voice at the time. Because when you're desperate, you know, you can't do anything. And I tried doing this slow walking meditation. Aren't we doing meditation? Have you seen that slow walking meditation? That I know many people do this slow walking meditation. I've got a retreat center opposite my monastery, which I built. And people do, we pass in a retreat where they do this very mindful walking. Do you know what I'm talking about? Very slow mindful walking. And this kid came running to see me. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you better go to your retreat center over the road. I said, what's wrong there? He said, there's all these zombies in your retreat center. Because this little kid, he'd been watching too many movies, and he thought the slow walking meditation, the zombies are coming. So to this day, we call that, just as a joke, zombie meditation. But anyway, once I go over this about the excruciating pain, I tried doing walking meditation. I couldn't do slow walking meditation. I was actually running. Can you address it when you're in big pain? And when your back is against the wall, and you've got excruciating pain that you cannot take any longer. There was a word which I remembered from my Buddhist learning, which is, let it be. You can hear that many times. You've heard it so many times. Now I had no choice. I had to let go. An amazing thing happened. As soon as I let go, and I had to fully let go. Letting go is not trying to find some other way of getting rid of the pain. It means stop trying to get rid of the pain. And then it went. Most amazing experience. 1 second you were in agony, not knowing what to do, and the next second you were blissed out of your head. The pain vanished in a moment, and I changed my attitude. And if you experience that once, you know exactly what to do again. Anytime you have excruciating pain, it's always that last option. Let it be. Then you have still got the physical discomfort, but 99% of pain is your mental reaction. And if you can actually overcome that, which is what you have power to do, it's difficult, but sometimes when your back's against the wall, you've got nothing else to do. You have to let go. The second part, terminal sickness, I mentioned this little story this afternoon. Imagine, is there a lottery in California?
Yep.
Okay, how much can you win?
Hundreds of millions.
Okay, suppose that you found out today that you won the California lottery. And now that you can go, say, over to Hawaii for a lovely holiday. And so you book the holiday to Hawaii, first class tickets, and stay in a 6-star hotel with thousands of dollars to spend every day. If you say you won that as a prize, not the lottery, you won that as a prize with some sort of competition. 2-week holiday in Hawaii for you and a partner, all expenses paid, first class, 6-star hotel, $1,000 each to spend every day. Would you be excited? Would you be counting the days until you go? Would you pack the night before and hardly sleep tomorrow and go in first class to Hawaii, 6-star hotel? Wow! That's like if you're about to die. What is better, going to heaven or going to Hawaii? If a person really believes in heaven and they realize they're terminally sick, and they think, wow, in 2 weeks I'm going to even better than the 6-star hotel in Hawaii. And you'd be so excited. You'll ask your doctor, can you please make it 1 week? The night before you're ready to pack and go, come on, bring it on. Why are people afraid of terminal illness? Because they don't understand what death is. Once you understand what death is, terminal illness, we're all terminally ill. Somebody once defined life, the meaning of life. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Yeah, it's very accurate, isn't it? So we're all terminal. So sometimes, you know, if you actually go visiting somebody in hospital, sometimes, please don't talk to the disease, talk to the person. Now don't go and say, how are you feeling? That's the most stupid question anyone can ask when you go to hospital. Of course I'm feeling bad, otherwise I wouldn't be in here, would I, stupid? Talk to the person. So when I go to the hospital, I tell jokes. I would treat them just as I would treat them if I went to visit them in a coffee shop. Treat them as a person. Because the doctors and nurses, they have to ask how the symptoms are, not you. And that means that don't get so afraid. They have a wonderful time with you. That's how I would treat someone with a terminal disease. You lucky thing, you're going to heaven before me. Change the attitude. And it's not so scary. That makes sense, sort of. I know we're going over time. Is that okay, boss? She seems okay. I'm okay with it. Any other questions? Or yeah, at the back.
I think that's a question about reincarnation.
Reincarnation, yes.
How many lives are we able to know?
How many lives? You're certainly able to know this life. And for those, I always say, there's many people in America don't believe in reincarnation, maybe some of your friends. But don't worry, if people don't believe in reincarnation in this life, they certainly would in the next. It's such an obvious thing that people get reincarnated. Okay, here's a nice little thing for you here. We always think just one life, which means a life has to have a boundary, a beginning and an end. So people ask, where did life come from? How does it end? And I take this back to the origin of the universe, because many of you are Buddhists, and sometimes your Christian friends will say, well, in Buddhism, how do you explain creation, they call it? And I say that you people who believe in creation are called flat timers. Just like many centuries ago, people believed in a flat earth. An earth which had boundaries, where you went far enough and you'd fall off. And of course, you know, Galileo and the Chinese got there first. They understood that the earth was not flat, it was round, it was a globe. It has finite area, but no beginning and no end, edges. And even today, most people understand the earth is not flat, but still many people believe the universe is flat. Just like I remembered as a school kid, wondering, this universe, when you go far enough, where does it end? Is there some brick wall? Or is there some fence with a government sign saying, no, you can't go further? How can there be an end to this universe? Because if there's an end, an edge, there must be something beyond the edge. It doesn't make any sense. It's a logical impossibility. And of course, when you start to go to a college, especially because I studied physics, they said, the universe doesn't have an end. It's curved. It's a limited space. You know, it's a finite volume, this universe we live in, but it has got no edges to it. And they gave the simile, just like an ant crawling over a basketball. Goes round and round and round, can never find a beginning or an end, but knows the basketball has got a limited area. Keeps going over the same area again and again. And that was a simile my professors used to describe this universe. It's a limited volume, but it's got no edges to it. That is science. That is accepted truth. No beginning to the universe in space or time. No edges, no walls. Now we go to the next step. Time. Too many people are flat timers. They think time has a beginning and an end. It has edges to it. And when you think that time has to have an edge to it, a beginning and end, then you've got the God problem, the creation problem. How did life begin? How did things begin? And the truth is, time doesn't have a beginning or an end. Just like the universe, just like planet Earth, it's round, it's curved. Limited duration without any edges to time. Now life. Why are you flat lifers? Always thinking life has to have a beginning and an end, has to have an edge to it. Now when you start to see the cycles of this universe, that things are always round. No beginning, no end, no edges, but finite. Then many of the problems, you know, of beginnings and ends of universes are all solved. Time with no beginning, no end, curved, just like the universe, just like planet Earth. People always thought the Earth was flat. Still, many people think time is flat. Therefore, they have the problems of beginnings. And then, what was before the beginning? Of ends? What's after the ends? What's beyond the boundaries, the edges of life? There aren't things beyond, because life goes on. Reincarnation, the circles of life. That's right from the mouth of the Buddha. Easy. So that solves a God problem. You heard it here. In a Jewish center. Oh my goodness. Any other comment, question?
So okay. Who do you pray to?
Pray to? Instead of praying, there's this... Okay, here's another story. I think many of you know this.
Just answer.
Apart from no one. You aspire and you ask for yourself from life, from friends, rather than praying to somebody or some being which you cannot see. You don't know who's listening, or if they're listening at all. Keep it real. It's true that if you aspire, you pray to some unseen being. At the same time, you're making an aspiration in yourself. In other words, you are tying in to some of your own innate abilities. Hope is really important, because when people don't have hope, they don't try anymore. So sometimes praying to a being which doesn't exist still gives you that hope, which works, which makes things better, which gives you confidence, which gives you energy, which makes sometimes you act. So as Buddhists, we don't pray to anybody, because a lot of time that wastes time. Don't pray to somebody, do something about it. So instead of praying that the world will become a better place, spend all that time you would have spent praying doing something about it. Just like many kids come to me before their exams. Say, Dambam, can you pray that I pass the exams? I say, look, you make better use of your time instead of coming to the temple and doing pray, getting into your books and doing some studies, some homework. That is more effective than praying. Yeah?
What do you mean by heaven?
By heaven? Okay.
In answer to the earlier question.
Yeah, okay. When a person, okay, this is a deeper, heaven realms are what you create, what you think you deserve. Because the mind is incredibly powerful. And as a monk, we know those powerful mind states. You create those heaven realms. So some of the heaven realms which you might see or believe, like, you know, angels with harps, I mean, that's just so, so 2,000 years ago. You know, these days, I mean, you create the heaven you want, you feel you deserve. And understanding that this is, you know, what you think you deserve means a lot of times people have guilt. They think they don't deserve happiness. Which means, you know, if you want to go to a heaven realm after this life, or even in this life, you can't get there because of guilt. Guilt is one of the worst things which causes too much suffering in people. If you think you deserve to be punished, you will. If you think you deserve not to have happiness in this life, you'll suffer. It is one of the reasons why in Buddhism we have this acknowledging your mistakes, forgiving them, and learning from them. No punishment. It's one of the great things I saw in Buddhism. There's no punishment. It was just acknowledging. Because if you have punishment, you won't admit your mistakes. You'll lie so you don't get caught. This is the old joke was, in one of the states, in the United States, which still had the death penalty, and they were actually enacting the death, they were executing people, there was this man, he was accused of a crime which carried the capital punishment, and he was obviously lying in court. And the judge told him, "Sir, do you realize the penalties for lying in court for perjury are very severe in this state?" And the man said, "Yes, I know how severe the penalties for lying in court are, but they're far less than the penalty for murder." Which is why he lied. And that's very similar for life. We will lie to our husband, to our friends, and to ourselves if we feel the penalty is less. Which is why people don't tell the truth. So I don't know if you've got children. Your children will lie to you if they are afraid of telling the truth. Which is what punishment does. Punishment drives truth underground. So Buddhism, we acknowledge, and there's forgiveness there, amnesty. You know, in those Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in South Africa and other places, when we give amnesty, which is no punishment, that is to get the truth out. So we can learn from it. Acknowledging, forgiving, brings the truth up to the surface, and then we learn from it. We don't punish. We learn to do better next time. When we punish, drives the truth underground, we feel guilty, and a lot of times we punish ourselves. It's a terrible thing, punishing yourself. You make mistakes, I make mistakes. I told people earlier that one of the biggest mistakes I made recently, I was doing a marriage blessing for a couple, and I was really tired, and instead of doing the chanting for marriage, I did the chanting for the funeral. For marriage. Because it was in Pali, they didn't understand what I was saying. And they're still happily married to this day.
When you said,
yeah.
What do you hope for?
Okay.
Why do you use hope?
You use hope to give a positive attitude. Because when we get depressed, we can't see any light at the end of the tunnel, as they say. We can't see any way forward. You know, life, we get totally enmeshed in the jungle. We can't see any way out. So what hope does, it convinces us there is a way out, and then we start seeking for the way out. So hope is another word for a positive attitude towards the future. And this is, again, one of my other sayings. In some times people said, why do people worry so much? And it's because we worry, because we think of the future in a negative attitude. We think of all the things which can go wrong in the future. We get diagnosed with terminal cancer, and we believe what the doctor said. I've known many people with terminal cancer still alive 10, 20, 30 years afterwards. But if you give up hope, you get so depressed, that diagnosis kills you. So I say, don't worry. You know that you used to have this sign up in the United States, "Don't worry, be happy." I changed that to, "Don't worry, be hopey." H-O-P-E-Y. Because when you worry, you look at the future with negative mind. When you're hopey, you're looking at the future with a positive mind. That's the difference. So hope is looking at the future, looking at not the things which will go wrong, but the things which may go right. Changing that attitude usually makes things go right.
I think we'll
meet again. Okay. Thank you very much for coming. The night is still young, but nevertheless, time to go. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That is, please excuse me, but that's very depressing. Now, in Australia, some of you have come to my retreats, come to my talks, you've seen them on YouTube. After the talk is finished, we do sadhus with some oomph, with some energy. So please follow me, here we go.
Song.
That's much better. Oh, Very good. All the best.
Thank
See you.
You
next time, next place. Have a good night.